give a minute.
I can go.
Good afternoon. This is the Joint Committee of Ways and Means, the Subcommittee on Public Safety. Today is February 20th, 2017. I'm opening the public hearing on House Bill 5042, which is the Oregon Youth Authority. And I know that we have all of these wonderful individuals with us today, and they're on their way up to the desk.
Offended you? I told Joe I cannot stay here. I have to go testify, Joe. Just kidding.
And Rep. Huffman left because they arrived here, and he was pointedly talking about Mr. Joe, and I will not repeat the last name. So.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair
Mr. Winter. Fairbairn, how are you this morning?
Thank you very
this
much,
afternoon.
Senator. Co-chairs Winters and Stark, members of the Subcommittee on Ways and Means Public Safety. For the record, my name is Fairbairn Spaksuresh, Director of Oregon Youth Authority. With me is our Deputy Director, Joe O'Leary, and our CFO Budget Analyst, Dustin Ball. Today, our presentation will begin with an agency and system overview. We'll talk about the youth who are served by the system and Oregon Youth Authority. We'll try to cover agency programs and services. We'll try to be flexible if we have time. We'll go into strategic initiatives. If we don't, we'll begin that presentation tomorrow with OYE Performance Management System. We'll cover Youth Reformation System and Positive Human Development, and the 10-year strategic plan for facilities. Tomorrow's presentation will primarily focus on the budget note that we received from this body in 2013, directing us to implement the Youth Reformation System and bring back a 10-year strategic plan for facilities. We'll share what you asked us to do and what we have accomplished. And then finally, on the third day, we will do an overview of our budget, talk about reductions in the governor's budget, as well as the 15% reduction instructions from Legislative Fiscal Office. We'll talk about the only agency bill that we have, and hopefully leave plenty of time for public testimony. As we go through our presentation, you will see occasional pictures of youth and brief stories about them and their accomplishments. We'll do this for a few reasons. One is that we're actually very proud of our youth and their accomplishments, putting their life back on a healthy and productive track. We are proud of our staff, our partners, our volunteers who've helped them improve their life and their future. And these stories remind us about why we do this work. It's about the kids, it's about families, it's about communities, and it's about victims. And we try not to forget that. My hope is that at the end of our presentation, you'll be as proud as I am of our staff and our partners in the work that has been accomplished. A whole lot has happened with the Oregon juvenile justice system within the past 6 years, and it has only been possible as a result of collaboration with our county partners, providers, and other system partners. We're being noticed and talked about nationally. I hope that you'll notice our accomplishments as well.
Just before you, I just have a brief announcement. Senator Steiner Haywood is not with us. I took her name plate and put it down, but she is with us online, and she will and she's listening. She's probably streaming.
Us.
Yeah, she's watching us, and so she'll probably from time to time will text and send me little questions to ask you. So just FYI.
Thank you, Chair Winters. I know that the senator had many questions, and hopefully if she feels better, we'll see her tomorrow. We have a whole lot of material to cover, so I'll turn it over to my fast-talking business partner and our deputy director, Joe O'Leary.
Co-chairs Winters and Stark. For the record, I'm Joe O'Leary. I'm Deputy Director of the Oregon Youth Authority. It's an honor to be here today to tell you about the work that our folks do and our partners do. It's also an honor to help steward the transformation that's taking place in OYA and juvenile justice. I will apologize in advance. I'm recovering from a bit of a cold. I'm going to do my very best not to sneeze or cough for the next 90 minutes with the help of some tea and cough drops here at my desk. Task is to talk you through some of the next several slides that tell you a little bit more about OYA as an agency and the juvenile justice system in Oregon. As Fairbairn's alluded to, our chapter headings are going to shift with some photos of youth who are in our care. I think several of you who have been at McLaren already have probably met this young man, Gustavo, who's a DOC youth at McLaren, who finished high school while in our care and is currently working on his bachelor's degree. He is a really talented artist, and he is one of the small number of youth who are training for the marathon that's going to happen within the fence at McLaren. Later this spring, it'll be the second marathon at McLaren, and as far as we know, the first such event in a youth correctional facility pretty much anywhere. The mission of the Youth Authority really does reflect that it's very serious conduct for which youth are committed to our care. And for that serious conduct, we are charged with holding those youth accountable. We believe that how we do that, how we deliver that accountability, makes a big difference. We want to reduce the likelihood of recidivism of these youth. We want to prevent their from being future victims and enhance the likelihood of public safety in our communities. But we want to do more than that. And our vision is not only that those youth are crime-free, but also that they are productive. And that productivity piece means that we want positive outcomes for them. We want them to be productive members of our communities in Oregon, to which most of them will be returning after their stay with the justice system. This is a system view of Oregon's juvenile justice system. And so those of you who have worked in law enforcement and the court system will be very familiar with this. Basically, you know, there are two key takeaways. One, OYA is a small part of a much bigger juvenile justice system in the state. If we were to put numbers around these boxes, just to give you a sense of the scale, there are about 390,000 youth in Oregon right now, and only about 2,600 of those youth end up being adjudicated for delinquent activity. Adjudication, of course, is the juvenile court word for conviction. And of those 2,600, about 2,100, so the overwhelming majority, are supervised in the local juvenile departments of the 36 counties in Oregon. So it's the juvenile departments, our very important partners at the local level, who are the high-volume workhorses in the juvenile justice system. The youth that end up in OYA care in a given year are in the neighborhood of 500, sometimes a little more than 500 youth that come to OYA. And they can be committed with two dispositions. The court has two options. One is the court orders the youth to be placed in a youth correctional facility. The other is the youth orders the court, the court orders the youth to be placed on OYA for purposes of probation. And generally, they're removed from the home. They're placed in a residential treatment program. And I'm going to show you where those are. There's one other way, and this is the other takeaway of this chart. The bottom red circle denotes the youth that come to the care of OYA through the adult court system. And this is, of course, through the nature of the underlying conduct. If it is a Measure 11 offense, charged as a Measure 11 offense, and the youth is convicted, even at ages 15, 16, or 17, those youth are placed in the legal custody of the Department of Corrections, but in the physical custody of the Youth Authority, so long as the conduct occurred before age 18 and the sentencing occurred before age 20. Those youth, by statute, are to remain in OYA's care and custody, physical care and custody, until they turn 25 or until their determinate sentence is over. So two categories of kids that OYA is responsible for the physical care of: these juvenile commits that come through the juvenile courts and the adult commits, which we also call DOC kids that come through the adult courts. The juvenile commits, the legal difference is OYA has parole authority over when those youth may be stepped down out of a close custody environment into a residential transitional leave or foster care environment. A couple of notes about the history of Oregon's juvenile justice system. And this Oregon's history really tracks that of many other states. It was around the turn of the century that in Oregon and many other states that courts were realizing that that there needed to be a separate system in place for the disposition of juveniles involved in delinquent activity. And then in the 60s and 70s, the rise of due process protections for those juveniles came across the country and also hit Oregon. And then almost predictably in the late 80s and early 90s, the pendulum began to swing a little bit further with the idea of treating youth more like adults. And in Oregon, the wave was represented by the voters' passage in 1994 of Ballot Measure 11, which permitted the automatic waiver of certain aged juveniles for certain crimes into adult court with penalties that were like adult sanctions, mandatory minimum sentences. And it's no accident that in 1995, the year following the passage of Measure 11, the Oregon legislature passed Senate Bill 1, which created the Oregon Youth Authority. It pulled the Oregon Youth Authority, or what was the Oregon Youth Authority, the Division of Juvenile Justice, out of the Department of Human Services and made it a standalone agency as it is today. A couple of points of analysis from this history that are really worth mentioning, and I'm going to kind of start at the bottom of this chart, so what I say might not track the order of the bullets. But the thing about Senate Bill 1, there were the seeds of the developmental approach in Senate Bill 1. One of the things that still makes Oregon very unique is the fact that youth who are automatically treated as adults are placed in the youth authority's physical custody up until the age of 25. There are very few other states. By our count, we think it's only two that do that. Our neighbor to the north, Washington State, is actually considering making their system more like ours in that respect in this legislative session. And that really makes Oregon unique. And also in the DNA of the Oregon Youth Authority, in our enabling statute, is that balance that's really called out of accountability and reformation. So our charge really is to provide treatment and education in safe environments. The other thing I want to point out that is pretty unique very important is the first bullet on this slide, the Juvenile Justice Information System, or JJIS. The framers of Senate Bill 1 had the foresight to say that, look, if we're going to have a statewide system of juvenile justice, we want to make sure that the youth who flow from county supervision to state supervision and maybe back to county supervision really have one case file. We don't want one county having a file over here, another county having a file over here, the state having a file, all for the same kid. So they asked the state and charged the youth authority with creating and maintaining JJIS, the Juvenile Justice Information System, that's governed by a board of county and state actors. And all 36 counties were directed to participate and were partners in this from the very beginning. And what it has done for us now, because this is such a unique thing, there are some other states that have like a couple of counties that have joined information systems, but no other state where every county and the state government shares this infrastructure. And what it has created is a backbone that's also the brains, really, of our system. And the data in that system today, 20-some years later, we are able to harness that data in ways that I think the framers of Senate Bill 1 only hoped that we could. And it is the engine that is driving our youth reformation system, which we're going to talk to you about, our youth use of predictive analytics, if you will, Moneyball for juvenile justice. I do want to note from a budget perspective, though, Well, JGIS was stood up in the late 90s, and it was pretty darn cool technology for the time. It has served its purpose and is badly in need of some updating. OIA's IS department supports the 3,000 users, some state but mostly county users, across the state that use JGIS, access JGIS in real time about the youth being served. It's a 20-year-old platform, and it's unable to adequately support the modern mobile web-based workforce platforms that we have available today. Additionally, Secretary of State audit after Secretary of State audit has called this out as an area for growth and improvement. Juvenile justice nationally moves more toward, and we want to be part of that wave. We want to be cutting edge of this wave to move toward data-informed models. It's absolutely critical that the JGIS application keep up. So effectively managing a project of this size is going to require a lot of thoughtful planning and dedicated project team. Both OIA and our county partners are going to need your help to make this happen. Speaking of partners, we have a pretty diverse slate of partners. The public, many governmental agencies, many advocacy groups, both from the victims' rights advocacy side of the equation to the youth rights and family side of the equation to our various business partners, all of them represented on our agency advisory committee and are really important partners to the business that we do. The next couple of slides will shift to tell you a little bit more about the youth we serve, their demographics, who they are, and where they're from. This young man, Brandon, started out at Hillcrest, earned his barbering license there. He's currently at McLaren, and he's a really outstanding young man. He's actually now teaching. He earned a certificate to actually teach barbering to other youth. He's giving back quite a bit by training other youth in how to become barbers. Here's a snapshot of the youth that were committed to OIA in the last year. Sometimes it surprises folks to see that OIA actually supervises more youth in the community than we do in close custody. Most folks hear OIA, they think McLaren, they think lockup facilities. We've got more youth actually in the community being supervised in foster care and res programs, independent living, and so forth. Of those 812 kids, some of them have been in youth correctional facilities and have been paroled to community settings. Others started out on probation, never went to a youth correctional facility. On the right side of the first chart, the YCF, that's Youth Correctional Facility, those are the youth in close custody. 566, again, this is a snapshot as of now, these numbers change. And if we were to granularize those 566 in close custody, what we see, and that's in the small pie chart to the right, is roughly half of those are OIA youth, over which we have parole authority, and the other half right now, a little less than half, are DOC youth who are serving determinate sentences. What got these kids into...
Joe?
Yes?
A question. Co-chair. Are you seeing a decrease or an increase in Measure 11?
Co-Chair Winters and members of the subcommittee, this is actually most recently a decrease in Measure 11 commitments. Last time we presented to you, this number was 50-50, and I think the time before that, the DOC commitments were maybe less than a dozen, but a couple of kids more than the OIA commitments. So I don't know if that's enough to... enough data to say it's a trend, but that's the most recent flux. Oops. The crimes of commitments of the youth, both OIA and DOC youth, the big three here are sex offenses, property offenses, and person crimes, that is assaults and assault-related offenses, followed in the single digits by drug and alcohol-related offenses, robbery, and weapons. I note that if you just look at the DOC population, the number of robberies is a much higher percentage, but this is overall the blended population. And now I'm going to give you a few demographic slides about the ages of the youth in our care. Legally, a court can commit a youth to OIA as young as 12 years old. And again, 25 is the age out. And you can see the ages of the general population in Oregon of youth. That's the pie chart on the left. And on the right is the ages of youth committed to OIA care. And the takeaway here is that about two-thirds of our youth are ages 16 to 20. Also a demographic slide next about the gender breakout of our youth. While the general youth population in Oregon is about 50-50 male-female, you'll see that our population is overwhelmingly male. The female, talk about trends, the female population, though small, is increasing and has been on a steady increase for the last several cycles. And we also see that the female population comes to us with issues that are much more acute than the male population, a lot of trauma, and generally they've been dealt a very, very tough hand. Next couple of slides are going to talk exclusively about race and ethnicity, which is a very important topic in juvenile justice. It's actually, again, back to the framers of Senate Bill 1, put something in OIA's DNA that actually directed us to keep data about racial and ethnic disparities, because even back in 1995, the legislature knew that this was an issue. The bad news is it still is an issue, and in some cases, it's gotten worse. Excuse me. This first slide shows you the population of youth in Oregon broken down by race and ethnicity on the left. And on the right, the pie chart shows you those youth who are committed to OIA care by race and ethnicity. And you will see what will jump out at you is the African American population is vastly overrepresented. The Native American population is almost twice overrepresented. The Hispanic population is slightly overrepresented. However, that is the one that I would note is not growing in disparity. The other two populations, Native American and African American, have actually gotten worse over the last many years. I'm going to granularize. Ooh.
Could you provide for us some breakdowns and trend lines with from counties on those populations? And you can get that back to us and give me a time span.
Yep.
On those, and the same is with the increase in the female population, so we can look and see what is occurring, because the same thing is occurring in the adult.
Yes.
For females. So.
Co-Chair Winters will get you both of those. Thank you for that request. So I'm going to go down two levels in the racial and ethnic disparity for the OIA population. This first one shows you the breakout between those youth who are placed on OIA community supervision and those youth who are placed in youth correctional facilities. And as I mentioned, you see that the deeper you go into the system, as it were, the more the disparities increase. And that is across both African American, Native American, and the Hispanic population. And then the last granularization, and this was one that was asked for in Judiciary Committee when we gave our overview, so we included it here as well. This is the granularized racial and ethnic disparity when you compare the OIA youth in youth correctional facilities to the DOC youth. So basically, these are the juvenile commits that get put in a YCF compared to the adult, quote-unquote, adult commits that become DOC youth that are placed in OIA's physical custody. And this is where some of the disparities are actually most jarring. African-American, the general youth population from the previous two slides is 3%, but the DOC commits of African-Americans are 16%. Native Americans, 2% general population. DOC commits 6%, and the Hispanic general popular youth population is 21, and it jumps to 34%. So again, this is not a question of opinion or conjecture, but rather a very serious fact.
Are we able yet to actually begin from foster care and the long placements and take that into OIA?
Senator, Co-Chair Winters, I think we can reach out to DHS and determine some of the racial and ethnic demographics for foster care. I am going to talk to you in a little bit about our feeder system study, which you have worked quite a bit on, in which we're taking a cohort of juvenile justice youth, and we're going backwards in time, and we're looking at the other.
I'll wait till you get there.
Okay, thank you. So this last slide about race and ethnicity, it's on the topic of race and ethnicity, but I'm shifting a little bit to our workforce. So if you bear with me, we just felt that this was a good place to put it so that you are aware. We're very committed to having a diverse workforce that reflects our client population. And I think this slide shows you that we're doing a reasonably good job. We're actually doing better than most. The statewide average for diverse workforce communities of color, part of the workforce, is 13.6%. If you look just at our direct care staff, we're at 22% from communities of color and 31% female. It's a little bit smaller, admittedly, if you look at the total workforce, but most of our workforce is direct care staff. We are committed to not being complacent about this. Though it is better than the state average, we know we can do better, and we're doing a lot of things to improve those numbers. Now I'm going to shift back to the youth population and youth demographics. This is also a really troubling slide. This is our version of the Adverse Childhood Experiences Survey. We do this every 2 years with all of our youth. What this shows you is the very, very difficult hand that these youth have been dealt prior to coming into our care. And the takeaway here is that even though these young men and women have committed very serious felonies, they were, in fact, victims before they were perpetrators. And many of them face mental health and developmental challenges. And, it's important to note, too, that we don't offer this purely to say, oh, poor them, to make us feel bad, but rather if we don't know what happened to them, we are not going to be as effective in helping them develop into productive and crime-free members of our communities when they get out. Where are these youth from? This chart tells you in some excruciating detail where the youth that are committed to our care come from. And as you might expect, these numbers pretty much follow the population distribution for each of the counties. Basically, the most populous counties commit the most youth to OIA, and the least populous counties commit the least number of youth to OIA. I'm going to start shifting to tell you where some of our programs are. The first slide shows you the location of our close custody facilities and work camp programs. This is where about 700 of our employees, the overwhelming majority of our employees, work in these institutions. They're represented by our labor partners in SEIU. Currently, we have about 566 youth in these close custody facilities. About only 56 are women. The rest are young men. And, of course, the Oak Creek campus in Albany is the only facility that serves young women. It's the Oak Creek Youth Correctional Facility and the Young Women's Transition Program, which is a camp-like program on the campus of Oak Creek. And it's worth noting that the governor's budget proposes permanent funding for the YWTP, which we opened in 2015 as a pilot, and we're really excited and hopeful that we'll be able to make that program permanent. I also want to note that the Hillcrest campus is noted with a star there in Marion County, but that will be closing pursuant to our legislative budget note from 2013. That'll be closing in July, and those staff and those youth will be merging with the McLaren campus. And we'll tell you more about that both today and on your tour later this week. And then I also want to note that the North Coast facility, which is the star up in Clatsop County in Warrenton, is proposed for closure in October under the governor's recommended budget. So that is also a budget issue that this subcommittee may wish to...
Co-chair Starr.
Joe, this is a question from the good Senator Steiner Hayward, who's watching and not feeling well, on the proportionate numbers per thousand on the counties. Do you have a chart that shows, you know, population? I know you said it's proportionate there, but what those actual numbers are.
Co-Chair Stark and Senator Steiner Hayward from the virtual world, I don't have a chart that shows that. If you'd permit us, we'll try to see if we can work that up. Okay. And get you that information as supplemental.
Thanks. If she doesn't like that answer, she will let
She'll
you know
text
tomorrow.
You again. She may text me, but I'm not checking my text. So I just showed you the close custody facilities. Now I'm going to show you the locations of our field offices and our residential programs. The field offices are noted by stars on this map. These are the field offices where our juvenile parole and probation officers, about 140 or so employees who are represented by our labor partners in AFSCME, work. These are the folks that supervise, that case manage every single kid that's committed to OYA's care. The triangles on this chart are our residential programs. These are not state employees. These are contract providers that are represented by the Alliance of Children's Programs. These are programs like St. Mary's in Beaverton, Janus in Portland, Homestead in Pendleton, Hag Home in Junction City, and Next Door in Hood River. These guys do great, great work for us. They are long overdue for a rate increase. This is part of the BRS, Behavioral Rehabilitation Services lawsuit. We'll talk to you about a little bit more today.
And, Joe, you're aligning yourself with DHS so that the rates are the same?
Co-Chair Winters and members of the subcommittee, we absolutely are. These providers are the same providers that do a lot of work in dependency matters, so for youth that are in the care of DHS, and we want to make sure that those rates are equal. As I understand it, the DHS budget and the OIA budget are mirrored for purposes of that increase. The lawsuit certainly named both of us.
Co-Chair Stark.
Thank you, Chair Winters. Also, are you going to comment, and if it wasn't in your presentation, can you comment on reasons for, you know, we've been hearing a lot about loss of beds in the state for, you know, res treatment and so forth.
Yeah.
Can you comment from your guys' perspective, what are some of those reasons?
Co-Chair Stark, we do have that in our, we have a risks slide that will come up, but it boils down to rates and regulations, and we've got about 10 or so fewer providers this year than we did a year ago, and it's a problem.
And out of that 10 boils down to how many beds or placements? Because if it's 10 providers, that's roughly.
Good question, Co-Chair Stark. I don't have that in the front of my head. If you'll give me leave, we'll figure out how many that is. Foster and Proctor programs are also a huge part of our network. The foster homes and Proctor homes on this map are noted with hearts, which I'm not being too cute by half. That is actually the official symbol of foster parents, is the heart. These folks truly open their homes and their hearts to our kids, a significant number of which just don't have family to return to when they leave either a close custody setting or a residential program. And we've got approximately 140 young people in these foster and proctor programs across the state, and they are hugely important to what we do. I'm going to turn the presentation back over to Fairbors,
yes.
Who is going to walk you through.
Co-Chair Stark.
Thank you, Chair Winters. Just on that, can you comment, what are the foster stipend rates for OIA?
It's a great question, Representative Stark.
I know it's significantly different than DHS.
Co-Chair Stark, I believe it is different. I don't have that in my notes. I'll have somebody answer it for me here in the back, and we'll get it to you before the end of the day, I bet.
And one more follow-up. Thank you. And then also, one of the things we've discussed with just overall foster care with DHS is the idea of a 24-hour hotline for foster parents when they're struggling can call and get, you know, kind of help and coaching and so forth. Do you guys have anything along those lines in place? Because yours is a special population.
We have a special, great question, Co-Chair Stark and members of the subcommittee. We have a special population. We also have specialized staff that actually are foster care certifiers that both review the placements and approve the placements, but also provide support to those foster parents. I think we have the advantage of being smaller. So, you know, with a couple of staff, we can provide a level of service that would be very hard if we didn't have, or if we had a much larger population.
All right, thanks.
So with that, Faribault is going to walk you through a couple of budget slides.
Thank you, Joe. The, some of this information has already been covered. OYA is a public safety agency that sits uniquely in between Department of Corrections and Child Welfare by design. The facilities and field offices Joe already covered are legislatively approved budget for this biennium is $298.6 million. Our total funds, $398.3 million. When you break that down, in the next slide, you'll see that the majority of those funds are spent in facilities that OYA operates and community programs that Joe talked about. Program support is about 9% of the budget. Just to note that program support is way beyond administration. There are many direct services to youth that take place in this part of the program. We'll break that down for you. The capital projects is primarily the money that was allocated to us as a result of the report back on the 10 years facility plan, the money that was allocated to renovate OYA facilities to address deferred maintenance and to align our physical infrastructure with our philosophy to serve youth. The debt service is associated with capital projects. Last but not least, payment to counties of $23 million and change. This is the juvenile justice reinvestment version of justice reinvestment. In fact, it was in place way before the adult system began investing in the communities. You can look at this money as expenditure, or you can look at it as investments. We look at it as investments because every dollar that's spent in local communities to keep youth in the communities and divert them from coming into the deep end of the system, keeps kids closer to home and closer to their families, and also at a much lower cost. There is a certain hydraulic in the system that as we invest fewer dollars in the communities, when more kids come to OYA, it actually compromises the balance of the system. So we are very proud of this investment. Our county partners are crucial partners. We can't do the work without them. The next slide, yes.
Rep. Stark. Co-Chair Stark.
Thank you, good Chair Senator. Good Chair Senator, there we go. On the capital projects,
yes.
Now I understand that roughly $50 million was from the budget we're just wrapping up.
Yes.
How much of that has actually been spent versus contracted to be spent versus just part of the plan to be spent? Because I know a lot of the construction that's been planned hasn't actually started.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, is there any, and not that we desire to do this, but are there any of those projects that if we had to, we could hit the pause button, even though we already put money into your budget for it?
Co-Chair Stark, we'll give you a breakdown tomorrow. We'll talk about our 10-year facilities plan. The short answer to your question is great idea, but I don't think it will work, primarily because the majority of that funds, those funds, are for closing Hillcrest and transferring the population to McLaren. We have a very tight time frame. That is July 1. We probably are going to miss that by a few weeks or a month, just primarily because of weather. We'll talk again about that tomorrow. The rest of the money is around deferred maintenance, and we clearly can talk about that. These are essential systems in facilities, HVAC, other infrastructure that can create significant costs to us if they fail. But again, we'll provide all the breakdown and show you what is already been spent and what's on the docket to be spent and what opportunities might exist for stopping projects. Absolutely.
Just to go back to the juvenile reinvestment dollars, similar to the adult justice reinvestment, are you going to at some point provide us with what the recidivism rates have been and how well we're doing?
Co-Chair Winters, we can provide numbers on recidivism. Recidivism is a bit tricky because it's measured differently in the local environment versus state environments. But absolutely, we'll provide recidivism numbers to you. And I believe that you'll be pleased that Oregon is doing fairly well at the national scene as well. Slide number 25 basically breaks down that money, the $23 million that's going to counties. You can see a range of up to $8.5 million, Multnomah County, to $2,800 to Wheeler County. Now, having said that, you see those numbers in red. Those do not include diversion funds of about almost $650,000. The 17 Central and Eastern Oregon counties pool their diversion money because sometimes individual counties don't get enough money to be able to spend on the needs that they have. By pooling this money, every youth is treated as a common youth among all those counties, and their needs can be addressed. This is a very unique partnership that has been noticed nationally. Central and Eastern Oregon Juvenile Justice Consortium, also known as COJAC.
Yes, Representative Huffman.
Really want to work with you to figure out the future for those counties and where it involves NORCOR, North Oregon Correctional Facility, and the DALs. It's challenging from a budgetary standpoint, and right now the four counties that are in the consortia to fund, operate, and support NORCOR is subsidizing the other COJAC counties or whatever they're,
right.
I've heard that term before from them in a briefing a couple of weeks ago. Anyway, it's something we're going to have to figure out. Because four counties, two of them quite small, about the size of Wheeler County almost, can't continue subsidizing for everybody. So we're going to have to figure something out there.
Co-chairs, Representative Huffman, we'll be glad to have that conversation. Primarily, from my understanding, is that the reduction in referrals has something to do with that. As the number of youth have declined, it's pretty difficult to maintain that level of service and pay for it.
Thank you.
Sure. Slide number 26 has OYA's organizational chart. Again, we'll cover some of these program areas. I just want to mention that program support includes director's office, business services, and development services. We'll cover some of those programs. And facility services and health services share the budget, even though their operational structure is separate.
Yes, Representative Huffman.
Thank you. And if you could bring, I'm asking everybody how many unfilled positions you have, how long they've been unfilled, why they're unfilled. So we can talk about that too.
Absolutely. We'll provide that in our budget report. Slide number 27 is our budget drivers and risk. Naturally, the number of commitments drive our expenditures and budget. The money that we send to our county juvenile departments, again, as I said, this is an investment and not necessarily an expenditure. Our BRS system that Joe briefly talked about and the rate increase that part of it has already been realized. Another part will happen at the beginning of the next biennium. Availability of residential services. As we get more mental health, youth with mental health, suicidal tendencies, medically fragile and high need, the placement of those youth becomes more and more difficult. As an example, in 2016, we had 13 youth placed in hospitals requiring one-on-one off-site staff supervision compared to only four youth in the prior 2 years, which included the youth with leukemia. Other budget drivers include difficulty recruiting specialized staff, particularly in the healthcare field, nurses, doctors, psychologists, specifically child psychiatrists, dentists, etc. Our deferred maintenance and building condition drives some of our costs. Roof replacements, water damage, mold containment. As an example, our sewer system failed in a Rogue Valley Youth Correctional Facility last year, which resulted in the closure of the kitchen. Luckily, it happened during off-fire season, and we were able to partner with our sister agency, Department of Forestry, and obtain a mobile kitchen that was on site for a number of months until we addressed that problem and rebuilt the infrastructure in the kitchen. With investments in our facilities, and part of it, Co-Chair Stark, is around these deferred maintenance costs, that is part of that money that we received last biennium, we hope to move from a current poor rating in our facility condition index to a fair rating in 2019 and ultimately to a good rating in 2021. Another cost driver is the high cost of construction due to improving economy and especially commercial construction. Residential construction has really jumped up as well. What this has resulted in is from the time that we did our assessment to the time that we actually produced some numbers to the time that we put the bid out, literally there had been a 20% increase in the cost of construction. As a result of that, we've had to delay some of the projects into the next biennium, take some of them off the plate just because the money was not enough to cover what we had planned to do. And hopefully in future phases, we can deal with those. JGIS modernization, juvenile justice information system, Joe already talked about that, is a pretty crucial part of our data and analytics work that we do, and JGIS is central to that. And finally, unfunded mandates, federal mandates such as PREA, Prison Rape Elimination Act, that has resulted in hiring a full-time coordinator, an investigator. We're contracting with state police to have a half-time lieutenant detective to work with us on addressing issues. $36,000 for doing audits. We've done 10 audits. We've been 100% compliant, and there's nothing necessarily wrong with this regulation. It's just that it wasn't funded. And there's a staffing standard that goes in place in October of this year, 2017, that's costing us about $610,000.
Barbara, just a quick question around PREA, not just the unfunded mandate, but also, and it's unfortunate that, you know, you as well as the adult facility, that things happen. And if I look at designs, and I know that you're having, working on the design at McLaren, old designs did not provide for, neither in the adult system nor the juvenile system, for the visual kind of be able to see your residents 24 hours a day. And I noticed just recently the Oregonian had this huge editorial on this particular issue, and I said, evidently, I guess maybe we should invite them to our facility so that they can understand the culture inside of and what happens in prisons and in jails and what have you, and if they're not constructed in a way to where some of the newer across this country are constructed differently. But unless we have a huge capital undertaking in this state to begin redesigning facilities, I don't know if we can guarantee that it never happens.
Co-Chair Winters, thanks for those comments. Naturally, we have a huge advantage over the adult system because of staffing ratios. We'll share some pictures with you tomorrow as far as the new design construction at McLaren that precisely addresses what you noted, line of sight so that we could have better supervision of youth. And as we tour McLaren later this week, hopefully we can point that out as well. The next slide is about what we call or has been called nationally the developmental approach. Within the past few years, a new philosophy has surfaced that has been in the works for a number of years. In 2013, a book, Reforming Juvenile Justice, a Developmental Approach, was published by the National Academy of Sciences. This book basically has brought to surface a new focus and a new way of dealing with juvenile offenders. Their focus is on pro-social development of youth with a particular focus on improving youth outcomes, creating safer communities, and reducing future victimization. The key consideration that this work emphasizes is not compromising on accountability, preventing reoffending, bringing fairness and equity to the system, and addressing the problem that the entire system has been facing for a number of years, the disproportionate contact with youth of color. The focus for youth reformation, again, this work talks about increased emphasis on scientific research. We all know about brain science. This has been happening within the past 15 or 20 years. is part of our youth reformation system, as you will hear about that in more detail tomorrow. But the core of this work is about a simple acknowledgement that youth are different than adults, and they should be treated and dealt with differently. They also highlight that healthy psychological development of youth is key to their future success. And they highlight three different points that's primary to making that happen. One is a parent or a parent figure who is very involved with the youth and totally cares about their future and their well-being. Second, a peer group that actually models the desired behavior in the youth. And finally, the presence or the skills that the youth needs to make decisions independently and engage in critical thinking. I think we'll all benefit if we had those attributes, but specifically, as it relates to youth, those are primary to their psychological development. As this work was happening at the national level, Oregon Youth Authority was already in the process of creating what we call the Youth Reformation System, focusing on addressing some basic but important questions, such as, what should be the capacity of our system? Are the right youth coming to us? Are they being placed in the right environment with the right treatment and intervention? Are we keeping them for the right amount of time? How do we know that the money that we're spending on the system is actually paying back and helping in reforming youth? And finally, what is bringing youth to us? And when we transfer youth back to the community, can we engage in practices that prevents a revolving door so that youth do not come back into the system? That is, in a nutshell, the youth reformation system. It addresses all those questions. It uses data, research, and predictive analytics to inform decision-making. Still, professionals make the decision, but with the data in front of them and with the benefit of having analytical tools to make those decisions. The goal of the system is to reduce future victimization and to maximize use of resources. As we began to implement the system, as directed by the 2013 legislature, Senator Winters knows about this because she wrote, co-wrote that budget note for us in 2013 that directed us to implement the system. We realized quickly that it was not possible to operationalize and implement the system without changing our own mindset and our approach to dealing with youth. And that's how positive human development was born. It is taken from a national model, positive youth development, which looks at youth as assets to be developed rather than problems to be solved. And it expands it to our staff and ourselves because we all are in the process of development and learning. We need our staff and partners. We need the right organizational structure to lead to youth success. The system begins with the core of safety and security. That is most important to our youth and to our staff. It builds on with caring and supportive relationships. We all require that. Youth require that to grow. Staff require that to do their best work. At the heart of this system is high expectations and accountability. It's also involves meaningful participation, youth owning their own future and participating in their treatment, and staff being engaged and meaningfully participating in improving the system. And finally, community connection, expanding the circle of belonging and allowing youth to give back to communities, whether it is within the facility or outside. Again, tomorrow, Dr. Shannon Myrick and Kirsten Kolb will go over in more detail around the youth reformation system and positive human development. With that, I'll turn it over to Joe to cover some of our programs.
We're going to dive into, give you a little bit about each of our operational programs. This slide shows you Austin on the left and Salvador on the right. These are youth at our Florence, Camp Florence Youth Transition Camp on the dunes at Honeyman State Park. These two guys are trained as barbers, and part of their give back program is to give free haircuts to homeless youth in downtown Florence once a month. We're really proud of them. The operational structure, Fairbourn showed you a chart that looks like this that has the position numbers in each. But again, I'm going to walk you through, well, actually, we're going to tag team some of these areas. We're going to do a deeper dive in each program area and give you kind of three bits of information for each program area. The first is going to be basically the 101, what it does. What do we do in community services? What are their responsibilities? Number two is going to be some defining points, major things that have happened over the last 6 or so years. And then number three for each of these program areas, we're going to spotlight one of the program areas, tell you how it's making a difference, and give you some breakdown on the data about how it's making a difference. The first program area we're going to highlight is community services. This is actually a picture of a foster parent and foster youth. Eldon is the foster parent on the left and Carlos on the right. Carlos is actually a graduate of Sprague High School in Salem, and he received an achievement award from the Salem-Keizer School District for his impressive changes in the last year. Co-chairs, if you'll give me leave, I'd like to recognize Phil Cox, who is in the gallery, who's the assistant director that oversees the community services section of OYA. Phil has a whole lot on his plate, and I especially would like to acknowledge him because he will be retiring this summer after 27 years of service to state government. We are really, really in debt to Phil. He's a source of great wisdom and institutional knowledge. To frame up that 27 years, I might note that in 1990, I think Co-Chair Stark and I were barely able to purchase alcohol legally, and that is the year that Phil Cox started with the predecessor agency of OYA at DHS.
I was not even close to being able to purchase.
The community services division really does a lot. This is where our juvenile parole and probation officers, our JPPOs, are located. They case manage every single youth that's committed to our care, both the OYA youth and the DOC youth. We do this through something we call the multidisciplinary team process. It's an approach that brings all of the important providers around a kid together every 90 days. They look at short-term and long-term goals, and that's what we do. That's how we case manage each kid that is committed to our care. They also, Phil's shop also oversees the community resources unit that acts as a resource to our contract residential providers. They are where our foster and proctor programs and the staff that support those foster parents operate out of. Representative Stark's question, the answer to Representative Stark's question about the stipend for OYA foster families, it starts at about $1,000 a month and bumps up to $1,342 a month. I don't know how that compares to DHS, but that is our rate.
Question, how difficult or not is it to recruit and retain both the foster parents and the proctors?
Co-Chair Winters and members of the subcommittee, we have, I think it is difficult. The answer is that this is a unique population because of the involvement with the delinquency system. It does carry a different connotation with these young people. But what I can tell you is that the folks that we get to do this work are super, super committed. And we make every effort we can to recruit. And frankly, we need to do better recruiting foster parents who are from communities of color as well.
Follow-up. And I'm going to go back in time a little bit. One of the things that we actually sought to do in the years I was with Children's Services was to develop actually professional foster parents. And I don't know whether that's been abandoned, whether that's gone forward. Looking at some of the skill sets that are required with some of the youth that you're having responsibility for, and whether some of those are the criteria that you're using in your recruitment tools.
Co-Chair Winters, I can't speak in depth to the training that is provided, but I know that there is training that is provided as well as ongoing in service and meetings for our foster parents. And again, as the folks in the Community Resources Unit and the Foster and Proctor Program in our central offices liaise with these folks constantly.
Representative, Co-Chair Starr.
Thank you, Co-Chair Winters. So just an informational comment, and then we have a question from our virtual doctor here in just a moment. So just so people can kind of compare rates, you know, DHS standard stipend reimbursement for a child, not counting like the CANS assessment and all that, for over the age of six is roughly 625-ish per month. So OIA is at 1,003 per month is kind of the starting, and then treatment foster care can be 1,600-1,700 per month, just so you can kind of see a variety there. And the question from our virtual doctor, though, is how do the kids participate in their own cases management?
Great question, Co-Chair Stark and Senator Steiner Hayward. I mentioned the multidisciplinary team process quarterly. The JPPO gathers the treatment providers, the educational providers, and the family of the youth. This is, though, a gathering around the youth. And the youth participates in the multidisciplinary team. Again, so much so that we're actually part of our culture change initiative is leading us to question whether or not we should call it something else. And it's in part informed by the youth perspective. If you're a professional, you might think, you know, have a connotation with multidisciplinary team. If you're a kid, you hear disciplinary. And if you're a kid in OIA care, you know that that's something bad. I don't want to
be going
to be
disciplined,
right?
Multiple times.
Yeah, exactly. So the youth
the
is
program.
The center of that process and ought to be a participant in that process. And so much so that we're thinking about calling it something else to better reflect that. Great question. This section of the agency also has staff that does specialized access to benefits, Social Security benefits, health care benefits, things like that, to make sure that the entitlements to which these youth are entitled are taken advantage of. We oversee the grants to the juvenile departments, the justice reinvestment grants that Faribault's mentioned, and oversee the interstate compact for juveniles. Couple of defining events from this program area, and as Co-Chair Stark mentioned, the changing in the residential landscape is the second bullet on there. Is one of the major changes in this world. We had 55 programs in 2015. Currently, we're down to about 46. The other defining event that's worth noting is the broad implementation of the Youth Reformation System tools. We're going to dig deeper into those tools tomorrow and give you a few examples of how some of the tools are being used in local case planning committees. Momentum for positive change. Two things that I want to mention lightning quick are our revocation work group and our runaway work group. Our performance management system, which we'll talk about in a little bit, shows us real-time data every quarter about a lot of measures, a lot of the health of our processes and our key outcomes. And one of the things that we were seeing over the last 2 years was an uptick in revocations and in runaways. And we put work groups together to actually study those phenomena and see if we could move the needle. The revocation work group found that using some of the YRS data, found that many of the youth who were being revoked were actually recidivating at a higher rate than would have been predicted for their type. So they put in recommendations to reduce the likelihood of revocation by recommending enhancements in independent living programs with enhanced life skills support, and by reallocating, and we're in the process of reallocating some of our community beds to follow that recommendation. The RUN work group looked at the question of why it seemed that more youth were absconding from community res programs. They recommended that programs do more reach in before the parole decision is made, so that youth actually had a better understanding of where they would be transitioning to. This kind of speaks to an enhancement to that multidisciplinary team process. And they also recommended an increase in the JPPO contact during the transition itself. The last bullet is really this next slide, so I'm just going to go to the slide. This is our spotlight in community services, and it is a program that we call the Transition Juvenile Parole and Probation Officers, or Transition JPPOs. We didn't create new positions. We actually repurposed four existing positions, four existing JPPOs, and we gave them a new job description. And we said, look, here's what we want you guys to focus on in different parts of the state. We want you to focus on community partnerships for youth with respect to employment and vocational training. We want you to focus on real-world soft skills development relating to maintaining employment. And we want you to focus on general life skills, money management, looking for housing, accessing public transportation, basic stuff, stuff that parents normally would help their kids do, or peers or mentors would help their kids do. And by the numbers, this program is showing really, really good results. We enhanced the service provision. So 20% of our parole and probation population actually got access to these enhanced services. And what we saw with that population was an 11% enhancement in the rate of school and work engagement within 30 days. So still soon, but very promising. That photo, by the way, is one of our transition JPPOs on the left, Heidi Lung, and a youth named Carissa at her high school graduation last June. Moving to facility services, our next.
Co-Chair Stark.
Thank you, Co-Chair Winters. Just wanted to clarify, I gave you guys faulty information just a moment ago, or misleading information on DHS rates. Not that it's that big of a conversation, but here, 6 to 12 is 655, but for your guys' population, 13 to 20 is the base rate is 741. So if you're trying to compare DHS versus OIA versus
Well, foster. I think that would be difficult anyway, because I think you're talking about your population and that which is required in addressing the needs of the population is so totally different.
For sure. I absolutely agree.
And that's why I asked the question of whether or not there was still the desire of developing the foster, the professional foster parent pool. Because, you know, I'm looking at some of the needs of some of the youth, and even in some of the younger population, it was deemed even when I was there, and that was a long time ago, that there was the need to begin to cultivate and have a cadre of individuals who could serve those special needs. So, and recognizing that we were going to have to compensate for that particular level as well.
Thank you, Co-Chair Stark. Members of the subcommittee, I'm going to move on to our next program area, facility services. This is a photo of a young woman named Shania, who at the time of this picture was at the Young Women's Transition Program on the Oak Creek campus in Albany. Upon her, she was a graduate at Oak Creek of the Wildland Firefighting Program there. Which is the first time that we've brought it to the female facility. It usually operates out of Riverbend. They came to Oak Creek. They gave a class at Oak Creek. Shania got certified as a wildland firefighter, and upon her release had a job in Redmond as a wildland firefighter, and we're really, really proud of her. And I should say the staff that are really committed to doing this this training for our kids. That program in particular really does unlock some leadership qualities that kids have, and they find a way to channel those skills and talents for the greater good. Facility services is comprised of seven youth correctional facilities and four transition facilities around the state. That's several slides ago. I showed you the map of where all those are located. You know, give or take 600 to 650 youth on a given day. That changes all the time. Living units are generally 25 youth in a kind of barracks-style living unit. You'll see some of those when you visit McLaren. What we're moving toward with the new units are 16-bed units with individual rooms. We need to have a better mix of dorm setting and individual room settings. One of the things that the 10-year plan study told us, best practice is to have more like 12 per unit. So we're moving in the right direction, but it's definitely a glide path. And it's really hard to describe everything, all of the services that go on in a facility setting, in a close custody setting. These are just a list of some of them. And in addition, alcohol and drug residential type treatment programs. Actually, several of our facilities, including the North Coast facility, are certified residential alcohol and drug treatment programs. And you'll get a much better flavor when you come and visit the McLaren campus on Thursday. Defining events, there have been many. I'm going to highlight the isolation reduction here as our highlight slide, so I'll skip it here. And I know you'll hear more about the 10-year plan tomorrow and the consolidation of Hillcrest and McLaren when you visit McLaren later this week. So one of the things I want to tell you about here is isolation, and that is really our highlight in close custody. We've been taking an intentional, multifaceted approach to reducing the use of isolation for several years, and we had a budget note in 2015, which Senator Frederick helped us write and secure, that really helped us focus our strategy on the thoughtful implementation of our culture shift in order to support a sustainable change around the use of isolation in close custody facilities. In 2014, we had already established an internal isolation oversight committee, which comprised of some management and direct care staff. And in April of 2015, we established an external community advisory committee that was made up of advocacy groups and content experts, including many of the organizations that would sue us and be in a position to sue us if we were violating the civil rights of youth in our care, ACLU, Youth Rights and Justice, Disability Rights Oregon, Partnership for Safety and Justice, and several others. That group, and I should say those two groups, really came back and helped us make a recommendation pursuant to that budget note for implementing a revised threshold for the use of isolation, limiting its use to those incidents where violence is imminent or has already occurred. It helped us revise documentation to more accurately reflect the reasons that youth were being placed in isolation, so we had to have a better sense of why those placements are happening and what's going on. And a budgetary impact of this was the piloted creation, which was also a redeployment of staff and a creation of specialized staff that we call reintegration skills development coordinators. These are the folks that are facilitating new processes that help prevent and reduce the time in isolation. These are staff that are helping youth successfully and more quickly return to their living unit when an isolation episode happens, and are helping us prevent those placements altogether. The governor's budget makes this pilot permanent. So several of those positions would become permanent, and we think this is absolutely critical to our efforts to continue to reduce isolation. We're also really proud on the policy side of Senate Bill 82, which will be on the Senate floor, I believe, on Wednesday, carried by Senator Manning, passed out of Senate Judiciary. It would codify our new policy that, longstanding policy that says that we will not use isolation as a punishment for rule violations that occur within a youth correctional facility. By the numbers, we have a lot to be proud of. The use of isolation has decreased by 5% for the last several years since 2011. And I want to call out our friends at the Rogue Valley Youth Correctional Facility in Co-Chair Stark's backyard in Grants Pass.
And I think that's why Co-Chair Stark has a comment or a question.
Sure. Apparently, I have a lot to say today. That's not why, actually. So kind of a two-part question. One is, for you guys, as far as physical interventions, what training system and documentation system do you guys use? Because you don't use OIS, I don't think. as far as the training, as far as, because there's organ intervention system, a lot of the residentials use that.
Oh.
What do you guys use for your hands-on training programs?
Thank you. Co-Chair Stark and members of the subcommittee, we have an internal homegrown training regimen around going hands-on. And then we use we have a physical defense component. Mm-hmm. That is actually an outside trainer that has trained some of our staff into that use.
And a couple follow-ups. So when you guys put hands-on, does your current system require documentation?
Co-Chair Stark absolutely does, yes.
And so, last one, I think. So with that, with the decrease in isolation, how have the numbers looked for restraints, physical restraints? Because I know, having worked in res,
right,
sometimes when you're trying to avoid isolation, that means right, you end up having hands-on and just physical restraints, and I'd like to see that.
Sure. Co-Chair Stark will get you those, and so the point is that we have a measurement for restraints, so hands-on might not end up in isolation. We have a measurement for isolation. The good news is we actually have an index of those facility safety measures, and they're all actually going in the right direction for the most part, but we can get you those.
Representative Barker. Thank you. So I just kind of curious, you know, sometimes we get criticized for writing too many laws. So you don't use rule violations to put somebody in isolation. Why do we need a law for that, to say that?
Great question, Co-Chair Winters and Representative Barker. Yeah, and what I would submit, two things really, what I would submit. One is that it's important enough that it ought to be codified in statute so that it's harder to change should the administration and leadership change. The other is, you know, every time our well-meaning national partners in the think tank world look at agencies, juvenile justice agencies, and they put out studies that say, you know, how many states do this and how many states do that, we always get dinged for not having a statute. I note that the juvenile detention facilities have a statute that applies isolation restrictions to them, but the YCFs don't.
Okay.
So it seems to make a lot of sense to
okay,
do that.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question. So yeah, I do the Rogue Valley props, a 36% reduction in the duration of isolation over the last year, and that's a testament to that leadership team under the leadership of our superintendent there, Ken Jaron. We're also, for the first time, really starting to break out the disaggregation by race and ethnicity. We were worried about what this data would show because, you know, you saw earlier how, you know, the deeper you get, the more the disparity impacts communities of color. And we were somewhat relieved to show that it is not as bad as we feared, but now we know, and we're going to keep tracking this information so that we have a handle on it. I'm going to turn it over to Fairbors, who's going to talk to you about our health services.
Thank you, Joe. We are running a bit short of time. We are going to try to move through at least the program areas today. As all of us agree, health is the foundation of well-being and leading a crime-free and productive life. And many of our youth come to us, as I've already shared, with unmet physical, dental, or emotional needs. And just like school credits, we're always in the catch-up mode, trying to get them to the point that they need to be based on their age. Health Services provides age-appropriate medical, dental, psychiatric, and psychological care for all of our youth in facilities in alignment with community care standards. It educates youth about how to manage their health and promotes healthy lifestyles. We are required by statute to provide health and medical care to incarcerated youth. Care is provided to our own staff as well as through contracts with outside providers, medical, healthcare professionals, etc. Medications are administered by the facility staff but overseen by Health Services. Over time, we've consolidated all of health-related services under one umbrella. Most recently, the psychology services has been consolidated. While our population has been declining, the acuity of some of the youth that are committed to our system has been increasing. As an example, in 2011, 74% of our girls and 62% of our boys were diagnosed with mental health disorder. Today, those numbers are 88%, and 75% respectively. So it is increasing. Youth with chronic medical condition can require expensive medication. As an example, in the 13-15 biennium, we spent $450,000 in medication costs for a hemophiliac youth. Health services also provides services for transgender youth. On a very positive note, we implemented an electronic health record system to contain costs, increase efficiency, and improve services by saving in transcription costs, eliminating paper costs, cost of transporting paper, and delaying basically care for our youth, cost of lost and misplaced files, and cost of duplicating tests and procedures. This has also provided immediate access to youth records, not only by us, but outside medical providers, because most of our medical providers use the same system. And it has created efficiencies associated with electronic pharmacy. Last but not least, we implemented this system at a fraction of the cost that usually costs to implement these systems. So,
Representative Sanchez. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. 2,881 vaccines administered.
Yes.
You can't be doing that many HPV. So you're telling me that these kiddos were so far back in their vaccines that they had, that's a lot of kids.
Co-chairs, Representative Sanchez, that is exactly right. Many of the kids that come to us are way behind what they need to be getting. We can actually get you a breakdown.
I would like
that. What those 2,880 are.
Thank you.
But yeah, absolutely. That's one of, especially as an example for dental care, many of the youth have never had dental care, and that directly impacts physical care.
I'm very interested in that as well. Thank you.
Absolutely. So you can see the numbers again. 10,726 triage requests, exams and intake, eyeglasses, 506, etc. The next, as we get into program support, this is a picture of Jesse on the right-hand side, a member, enrolled member of Cow Creek Band of Umpqua Tribe of Indians. What they're doing in this photo is doing Native American beading. We also have sweat lodge services and a number of other Native American services that is provided by our Office of Inclusion and Intercultural Relations, which is part of our program support section. And as we move into our program support section, we see that it includes business services, which are just basic infrastructure support for any organization. You can see the list of those. In the director's office, we have the internal audits. We are probably the only, perhaps, state agency that actually have volunteer outside individuals sitting in our internal audit infrastructure and actually chairing it. James Taylor, a commercial banking professional, actually chairs our internal audit committee, and that's primarily for transparency. Our Office of Inclusion and Intercultural Relations, Joe will talk about, we'll talk about performance management tomorrow. Professional Standards Office, again, if Joe can talk fast, we can get over that today. Research, we've significantly invested in research capacity. Senator Winters knows about that, and that has resulted in some of the things that we'll share with you tomorrow. And finally, rules, policy, and legislative coordination. I just want to pause for a moment and acknowledge Gail Shipley, who has provided public service to us at the national and local level for over 20 years, 6 years serving at the Oregon Legislature. She's retiring this spring. You might ask, why are these people retiring? It's really because of Joe. It has nothing to do with me.
Yes. That's the role of the deputy.
Yeah. I'll remember that.
Absolutely. So, defining events, in my time with OIA, we've experienced two budget reductions. We're going into a third. And as a result of those, we've had basically to thin our infrastructure. We're still trying to recover from that. We talked about PREA. Our 10-year strategic plan for facilities allows us to reduce our deferred maintenance, but naturally, it's a defining event. Again, this next point, Senator Winters well knows about because she is a sponsor of this project, data sharing amongst a number of state agencies that allows us to talk about the elements that bring kids into the system and how to transfer them back into the community successfully. As far as using momentum to drive positive change, we are in the process of creating a data warehouse to allow our researchers and analysts to better access data. And then Joe will offer, very briefly cover our Office of Inclusion and Intercultural Relations.
Thank you, Fair Boards. There are so many things to spotlight in the budget section that's program support that go well beyond administrative functions in our agency. This first
yes,
spotlight
5 minutes, Joe.
Is about the Professional Standards Office, which is our internal affairs division that oversees investigations and liaisons with law enforcement. These guys carry a huge, huge workload. This came as a recommendation in 2005. This agency didn't have an internal investigation function, and some very profoundly tragic events in the agency's history prompted the legislature to fund one investigator and one admin support. We've double filled because the workload is just so much greater. We have about three investigators now and one PREA person and two administrative supports. Governor's budget would make one more of those investigators permanent. It's badly, badly needed. These guys do a good job, and they're critical to our credibility and transparency in youth safety. The Office of Inclusion and Intercultural Relations, formerly known as the Office of Minority Services, is a team of 13 with statewide reach. And these guys are and women are responsible for our culturally responsive services in all of our facilities, both providing it themselves and brokering it and training the staff and facilities about cultural responsivity. Again, by the numbers, there is a lot of work that is going on behind the scenes. We've had a great increase in the number of Native American events over the last few years. And one of the things I wanted to highlight here was our tattoo removal program. This started in 1997, and since 1997, a 450% increase in the number of youth served. The number of youth right now get is about 45 youth, and there's a 250 youth waiting list for this program. It is subsidized by volunteers, five doctors and one nurse, and the equipment that we have to do this was donated and is close to end of life, and we're trying to find ways to keep it going and bring it to the next level. And finally, the last highlight in program support lives in research, the feeder study, as has been mentioned. So what we're doing here is we're linking data in partnership with DHS, OHA, DOC, Department of Employment, State Police, the Department of Education, and 36 juvenile departments. And we're linking data between a cohort of youth that are in our care now, and we're going backwards in time and looking at what other public agencies they access, what other services they access. And we're asking a couple key questions. We've had some answers to them already. One, are there opportunities to intervene and change trajectories of youth before they get to juvenile justice when they're hitting some of these other systems? The answer is yes. We got a study that shows you that. Number two, can we identify where to target those interventions? The answer is yes. Short answer is child welfare, mental health treatment, and alcohol and drug treatment. Third question, are there certain patterns and characteristics that predict future OYA commitment? And the answer is yes. One of the most recent studies we've done looks at the education data, and the predictor there, the biggest predictor, which came as a surprise to some of us, when we looked at this cohort who is in OYA now, we went back to their fifth grade year, and what we saw is this huge spike in changes in schools mid-year, and that was the biggest predictor of future juvenile justice involvement. So this is just the beginning. We hope that this work, if continued, will inform budget and policy decisions over the long term. The last program area is our newest. It's the development services area. This is a result of a reorganization in the fall. Again, we didn't create new divisions. What we did was basically move things, some functions around that had previously lived in facilities, it lived in community services, and a few of them actually lived in business services. And we took these functions that you see on the screen, the strategic planning, the treatment services, education, training, that is staff training, juvenile justice information system, and family engagement. We put them under one umbrella. And our touchstone here was integration and efficiency. And again, this is a new unit. Really pleased so far with the acceleration and the momentum of our transformation that's being driven by these folks, and they're integral to our operations. They touch every part of our system. The highlight that I want to tell you about in our final moments is a great program that you are going to see when you visit McLaren. We call it the University of Life, or the U. And what we did was we replaced a program that was taking assaultive aggressive youth and very reactive trauma-exposed youth who were engaging in assaultive behavior, and they were ending up in this long-term unit together. So what could go wrong, right? Willful assaultive aggressive youth and trauma-exposed reactive youth put in the same environment. So we closed that unit. And actually, we closed this physical environment down for a couple of weeks. And the development team brought the staff that worked on this unit long-term, and they said, look, if we were just going to focus on the trauma kids, what would we do? What's the best program for them that we could build? And we did a better job using assessments, some of the YRS information at the front end at intake to identify these trauma-exposed kids and to place them directly in this unit. This unit has a much more robust youth-to-staff ratio. It's about 5 youth to 1 staff. And the shift is really away from the compliance incentive model that works pretty good for the mature older kids, but doesn't work at all for the trauma-exposed younger kids. And we really moved this from that kind of model to an emotional regulation and skill development model. By the numbers, again, this is still early, but when you look at the 100% of these kids have had trauma histories, DHS involvement, and all of them are on psychotropic medications, and you see a 77% decrease in youth incidents. Those are assault, unexplained injuries, things like bad stuff, right? A 77% decrease in that and an 84% decrease in isolation. I'd submit to you that we were really on the right track and have a great pilot going.
Thank you. Representative Stark, and then we'll Sim.
Thank you.
Coacher Stark.
Coacher Winters.
Sim, yes.
So, two things from Senator Steiner Hayward, just saying thank you for letting her participate via digital world, and also letting you guys know that she would really like more information on the data sharing and have to continue that conversation as well.
We love Co-Chair Stark and Co-Chair Winters. That would be, I think, a ripe, not to suggest, but that'd be a ripe phase two. Deep dive.
I'll go back, and yes, that will be shared, and it's one that I'm very excited about. The data sharing, the director and both of DHS and Fair Boards and DOC and others have been having dinner meetings with me at night, offline, with the work that they're doing, and I've encouraged them to continue it. If you notice the conversation that was open, that these young people were victims. The other thing that you heard that the data that's coming out, the touch points that have occurred into other agencies like DHS and what have you, the question becomes, can we not start doing some earlier intervention to begin to stem the tide? And so I just have to give kudos to the agencies that have been working on this for the last, 2 years? Or so. Some other things that are coming out of this, and I want to thank OIA and DOC. That's the whole risk assessment tool that's coming out that is used by OIA, but also we believe can be used by DHS. So there's a lot of work that's being done by the agencies, and I want to applaud you. I just invited them to dinner a couple years ago, and we sat around and we talked. OIA and DOC was already there and invited the others. It's very exciting, and it started with them using their own dime for us to get here where we are. So,
thank you, Co-Chair Winters. Tomorrow we'll highlight some of those tools and how they're being used by all of our county partners in some cases. And there is incredible potential and promise. And not many agencies ask to come back for phase two, but we actually would like to come back and share some of the work with you.
Okay. And with that, there's no further questions?
I got another meeting.
Okay. We are adjourned.
Did you want to say something?
Question.
So, this, that, when is our marathon?
I think this is April. I can get you the date. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm interested.
So great to have you.
Oh, I'm
so great to have you.
Oh, I'm.